Okay. Hi. And just checking to make sure that all is recording properly. We begin. I'm somehow managing to continue this morning. Many things to do here, but this is Video Commentary 7, and I hope I'm not interrupted in the middle of it. We're continuing with this discussion of spirit. Let's see, how did it? Spirit, soul, and body. And I think first, this is spirit, life, and energy. These are all equivalent terms. And the question is being equivalent in there as well? There seem to be some distinctions between spirit, which has a vibratory feature, and being, which I think is non-vibratory, because non-divisible. Eventually, when the initiate has undergone the higher solar initiations and can function in the full consciousness of the monad, awareness of that which is divorced even from group form and from those nebulous sheaths which veil and hide the one becomes possible. Okay, well, what are the higher solar initiations? Let's just say the sixth initiation gives full consciousness of the monad. But the higher solar initiations, we might say, are the fourth, fifth, and sixth. Of course, I think solar initiations continue until the seventh, and then really at the fifth initiation, Sirian initiations begin. They are still, some of them, solar, but they also have a relationship to development on the star Sirius. Right. Okay. So we rise still beyond the group and beyond what he means here by nebulous sheaths which veil and hide the one. He does really, I think, let's see if I can, what is the matter here? I'll go back just for a moment. He means the vehicles of the spiritual triad. My impression of the spiritual triad. These are the sheaths which veil, still veil and hide the one, and they are nebulous. Right. I always forget to to start my, if I'm too much in a hurry, you know, I don't start my chronometer. All right, well, now it's started, and I'll have to be careful stopping a couple of minutes early. The highest types of consciousness work from the plane of the monad as the initiate of lower degree works from the plane of the soul and uses the organs of perception, if such an unsatisfactory phrase is legitimate, and means of knowledge of which average man has no idea. And what is the plane of the monad? The sixth plane. Whoop. Let's see if I have the sixth plane. All right, I'll just do it normally. Is the plane of the monad. But what about the logoic plane? The liberated monad finds its place there. But this is simply an analogy that just as these initiates of high solar degree and even of Sirian degree work from the plane of the monad, so does the lesser man work from the plane of the soul. And we're trying, even as we reach towards the third initiation, to learn how to work from the plane of the soul. They penetrate or include within their radius of awareness the sum total of life, consciousness, and form which we designate as God, is this meaning the God of our planet, the planetary logos? I don't think that they can, they cannot grasp the entirety of the solar systemic God, the solar logos. Not yet, I think. Although there is some awareness, naturally, and even awareness, perhaps, of some vibrations from Sirius, if we are working beyond the fifth initiation. These initiates of high degree then begin to be aware of a vibration, a revealing light, a note, what should we call it? Vibration, a revealing light, a note, a directional indicating sound, which emanates from outside the solar system altogether. So whatever we've been calling God is within the solar system and beyond EY, beyond the solar system are found the vibrations of Sirius, for instance, of Sirius, and even of the cosmic logos, which includes our solar logos and the logos of Sirius. And this is the Lord of the seven solar systems, of which ours is one. We can use those words, but what in the world do we mean? We look high into the sky, you know, and perhaps see some of these stars, but really, what do we mean? We cannot imagine what is the nature of such beings. And, you know, to speak glibly of the galactic galactic logos, well, it's a matter which is theoretical even for our masters, although we are told they have identified, apparently, a quality which comes from various galaxies. But then you look into what Hubble is now revealing and other cameras which are in process. Amazing what the fifth ray can do. And we just see millions of galaxies, each with their own quality. And these galaxies, okay, they are no doubt in groups, and there are logoi which comprehend the groups of galaxies, and maybe in which galaxies are as chakras, and so forth. So it's vast, isn't it? And if we can begin to appreciate the vastness of the system in which we are engaged, then perhaps some wearing away of irritation would occur, as Master Moria tells us, wear away irritation through cosmic perception. Well, we're certainly involved in cosmic perception. Perhaps not long in this book. When we're dealing with cosmic fire, we were constantly dealing with cosmic perception, but here the Tibetan ventures into cosmic perception sometimes to define the more abstract terms. Later the book, I think, gets very practical, but he's never very far away from taking us into the cosmos occasionally, and for that I'm grateful. The only way in which we can get an appreciation of the process followed in the expansion of the divine consciousness in man is to study the relation of the mind and the brain, and note what follows when the brain becomes the intelligent instrument of the mind. So there are sensitive and insensitive brains, and the awareness of the mind through the brain is constantly expanding. So, you know, we have brain cells and they are sensitive or insensitive depending on our level of evolution, and the more sensitive brain cells can simply pick up more of the content of the mind. But the mind is not the brain, and I don't think that it is possible for all that is within the mind to register in one particular brain. Well, maybe for advanced initiates, I don't know. Then study the relation of the soul to the mind and what eventuates when man is directed by his soul and utilizes the mind to control the physical plane activities through the medium of the brain. So then we have that very desirable alignment that we call soul, mind, brain, and we usually leave the astral body out of it, as it is a troublesome factor until subdued and rendered attractive to the divine love of the Buddhic plane. In these three, soul, mind, brain, we have the analogy and the clue to the understanding of spirit, soul, and body. Of course, it is somewhat reduced. It is microcosmic. Soul is symbolic of spirit, mind is symbolic of soul, and brain is symbolic of body. And their mutual functions. This was the subject matter of the book, The Light of the Soul, and we're told that the masters study even the last two books of The Light of the Soul. Such was the power of this initiate that we call Patanjali, and he lived long ago. There were many Patanjalis, we're told, but Patanjali, the one who wrote the Yoga Sutras maybe 10,000 years ago, somehow that figure sticks in my mind, I'm not certain. Upon the perfecting of the conditions dealt with in that book, there follows still another expansion when the spirit aspect, man's emanating source of energy, let's call it i.e. the monad, begins to use the soul via the intuition and to impress upon the soul consciousness those laws, knowledges, forces, and inspirations which will make the soul the instrument of the spirit of monad. And therefore, here's what we find. I think, you know, I'm not sure that Blavatsky presents it this way, and sometimes I've taken exception. The spirit has content of knowledges, forces, and is the source of inspirations. So, you know, the spirit, I'll capitalize it, is not blank and passive. Sometimes HPB writes of the blankness and passivity of pure spirit, but, you know, it seems somehow like the prime mover and full of high spiritual content derived from the higher planes through which it has emanated. So a soul will bring laws as well, laws. It has the content of laws. Yeah. Right. Knowledges, forces, and inspirations. And the soul will be the recipient of these. It's another phase. Just as the personal man became, at an early stage, via the mind, the instrument of the soul. So, spirit is the wielder of the soul instrument. Always there's something to add to an achieved state. And even if we achieve the ultimate state in any universe, universal logoic consciousness and power and identification, then absolute infinitude waits and reweights for us as it ever has with the disappearance of the universe. The disappearance of that limited extrusion, which we call a universe. As the soul assumed control via the mind, so the brain became responsive to the soul. So the way that the soul makes its way into the brain is via the mind. So let's put it this way, soul affects the brain via the mind. Man was awakened to a knowledge of himself. It may have taken 3,000 or 5,000 years after the implantation of the extension of the solar angel, angel of the presence, into the brain and into the mind, but eventually he awakened in the period of Leo, we are told, not just of Sagittarius. Man was awakened to the knowledge of himself and he, as he really was, and to the three worlds of his normal evolution, and we would say, as the soul via the mind made its presence felt in the brain. Later, he became group conscious and was no longer a separated individual. It is limited perception which creates the apparently separated individual. So, soul, mind, and brain, this is our desirable alignment. As the soul is brought under the dominance of the spirit, an analogous two stages are likewise seen. And it's only later, in relation to the higher initiations and past the third, that soul is brought under the dominance of the spirit. The spirit is generically related to the first ray. Being is related, somehow to all the rays. Get rid of this, get rid of this. Being is related to all the rays and is the source of all the rays. But spirit seems to be related to the monad, and while it is encapsulated on various levels of the cosmic physical plane, at least, has a ray associated with it. But generically, the first ray is associated with spirit when the word spirit is being used in this way and not to represent pure being. As the soul is brought under the dominance of spirit, an analogous two stages like are likewise seen. First, the disciple becomes aware not only of his group and allied groups, but his consciousness is expanded to what might be called planetary consciousness. So it is the influence of the spirit or monad which renders human consciousness planetary. That's interesting because the monad is a like a cell within the planetary logos, and the monad spirit has its home within a kind of heart center on the cosmic physical plane, a heart center of the planetary logos. So, somehow the monad is in hearing within the planetary logos and is in a way in hearing within Shambhala. But before the entire man can enter Shambhala, much development must occur. All right, so as the soul is brought under the dominance of the spirit, what happens? We become aware of the one. Let's just say the planetary logos is, in this context, the one. Of course, there are greater ones than the planetary logos, but the group is consisting of all the many entities within the dense or more refined environment, and looking at those all together as expressions of the planetary logos, we get the sense of the one. Secondly, he begins to merge that planetary awareness into something more synthetic still, and gradually develops the consciousness of the greater life, which includes the planetary life, as man includes in his physical expression such living organisms as his heart or brain. Well, and I suppose the next being up is the soul of logos, And indeed, our planetary logos plays an organic role within the solar logos. In this case, the base of the spine, and I suppose related, as in man, to the adrenal glands within the solar logos. When this takes place, he begins to comprehend the significance of spirit, the one life back of all forms, the central energy, which is the cause of all manifestation. We can extrapolate from this, but basically we are discussing realization of the solar logos and its oneness with respect, with regard to, with RSP, with regard to the entire solar system. Oh, boy, you know, DK is really taking us on a trip, isn't he? Just think of how he has contributed to the expansion of our mind. The first reaction of the average student on reading the above is to think immediately of the body nature as it expresses some type or other of energy. Thus, the duality is the thing noted, and that which employs the thing is present to the mind. So, duality is reflexively perceived. Yet, one of the main necessities before occult aspirants at this time is to endeavor to think in terms of the one reality, which is energy itself and nothing else. And what is energy? There are different ways of defining it in physics quite concretely, but energy really is life and is spirit. When we're thinking, you know, energy is vibratory from one perspective, and spirit is vibratory from one perspective, is life vibratory maybe from a lesser perspective, but then all of those terms can be used to be equivalent with being. And since there's no division in being, there can be no vibration. So from the higher definition, life is non-vibratory, spirit is non-vibratory, and even energy is non-vibratory. That's an interesting question, you know, how high does vibration extend? There has to be separation if there is to be vibration. Any kind of movement requires separation, and at least two. One, separation of one thing from another. You need a point of reference if there's to be vibration. And movement requires limitation and multiplicity. Being has no limitation and no multiplicity and no division within it. Therefore, it is of value to emphasize in our discussion of this abstruse subject, we will all agree, the fact that spirit and energy are synonymous terms and are interchangeable. So as I said, there's vibratory spirit, apparently, and vibratory energy, and maybe if we elevate to the definition of spirit, we will find non-vibratory spirit equivalent with being, and non-vibratory energy equivalent with life. Although, when I think of the word energy, it doesn't quite reach the homogeneous status of life or being. Well, we're splitting hairs here as we try to refine our understanding of some of these higher states. Only in the realization of this can we arrive at the reconciliation of science and religion, which must come, you know, sixth and fifth ray together, Master Jesus, Master Hilarion, working together, and at a true understanding of the world of active phenomena by which we are surrounded and in which we move. So there are many scientific understandings to yet emerge in the human consciousness. And these understandings will clarify the true role of religion. So in the Aquarian Age, we will have a scientific religion, the New World Religion, scientific, and dealing with the invocation and evocation and distribution of energies from the One Energy. It will be altogether more interesting than the simplistic approach to God and heaven or hell that now captivates the minds of so many people. The terms organic and inorganic are largely responsible for much of the confusion and the sharp differentiation existing in the minds of many people between body and spirit. Because, as Blavatsky said, you know, they are the same, essentially. Between life and form, and have led to a refusal to admit the essential identity and nature of these two. So, life and form are one, body and spirit are one, organic and inorganic. Maybe there's nothing inorganic. We know the basis of the differentiations. It has much to do with movement and growth, and even the degree of hardness of the kinds of materials we are examining. The inorganic materials belonging to the mineral kingdom tend to be harder and less penetrable, less moving, more confined. And the organic materials, let's say, belonging at first to the vegetable kingdom and beyond, have a certain softness and pliability and a kind of sensitivity which we have refused to acknowledge in the mineral kingdom, though some people have measured a kind of sentiency in the mineral kingdom. I think the Indian scientist is his name, Bose, B-O-S-E, something like that. The world in which we live is regarded by the majority as really solid and tangible, yet possessing some mysterious power lying concealed within it. Well, certainly atomic energy has proved that, which produces movement, activity, and change. This is, of course, putting it crudely, but it suffices to sum up the unintelligent attitude. So basically, when we're looking at the world around us, we are looking at densified light, and with light we have definitely vibration, light and matter being synonymous terms, but at different degrees of density. What we call matter is a densified light, what we usually call matter. The Orthodox scientist is largely occupied with structures and relationships, with the composition of forms and with the activity produced by the component form parts and their interrelations and dependencies. Okay, let's just call it the study of the object, of the parent object. We're not dealing with a translucent world. We're not dealing with a transparent world. We're not dealing with the subtle world. So, you know, science is very much under the influence of the grossening influence of Mars, under the influence of Mars, which renders the process crude in a way and external. But increasingly, we've seen that the nuclear physicist of the current age is penetrating far more deeply into the subtleties of matter and light, and is on the verge of discovering that type of matter that we call etheric and which is substantial to ordinary matter. The chemicals and elements and the functions and parts they play and their mutual interactions as them, compose all forms in all the kingdoms of nature, and are the subject of their investigation. So let's just say, at this time anyway, in the late 20s, but, you know, already it was beginning to open up into a subtle investigation, but this is largely the description of a crude outer type of investigation. The nature of the atom, of the molecule, and the cell, their functions, the qualities of their force manifestations, and the various types of activity, the solving of the problem as to the character and nature of the energies focalized or localized in the differing forms of the natural or material world demand the consideration of the ablest minds in the world of thought. So he's not saying that this should not be done, or it is not a worthy subject for the investigations of the scientist, because after all, the atom, the molecule, these are tiny structures, and they have their own inner dynamics, and upon these dynamics, much of our welfare or its opposite in the more macro world depends. So these are micro investigations relatively, but there are still more micro investigations which are now coming to the fore, you know, 90 years later, 70, 80, 90 years later. Yet the questions, what is life, or what is energy, or what is the process of becoming and the nature of being, remain unanswered. Here the philosopher and the scientist must blend, if possible. The problem as to the why and the wherefore is regarded as fruitless and speculative and almost insoluble. So it is even more difficult to solve the question of purpose. Why has all this come to be? And when we are asked that kind of question, well, nothing truly satisfactory comes to mind. One can offer various reasons, but when we're dealing as with the absolute deity, as if the absolute deity were absolute infinity, then many of the reasons for the coming to be are apparently negated. Why should the absolute arise as the absolute deity, which sees itself as absolute infinity and the extrusion of a tiny, tiny portion of absolute infinity into an isolated, limited universe? Why should all this happen? Nevertheless, through pure reason, which is the city of the buddhic plane, and through the correct functioning of the intuition, which arises on the fourth subplane of the buddhic plane, these problems can be solved and these questions answered. So if we don't know the answers to these questions, then perhaps we have not achieved true intuition. That seems to be the implication. Their solution is one of the ordinary revelations and attainments of initiation. Well, you know, I think about the initiation of a human being and then the initiation of greater beings like solar angels or triadal spirits, or the kinds of lives that produce the monads, or the planetary logoi, or solar logoi, and I keep on thinking that there must be many, many revelations far beyond the ken of man that are part of the initiatory process of these greater and more advanced beings. But let's say that when we achieve pure reason on the Buddhic plane, much will be clarified. That seems to be a reasonable promise, and we look forward to that clarification, which the concrete mind, of which the concrete mind is not capable. So, answering these questions, their solution is one of the ordinary revelations and attainments of initiation, and we might say, and I do believe it is true, okay, here we go. Try this, ESPL, especially of the higher initiations. The only true biologists are the initiates of the mysteries. Another powerful statement, which certainly can be misunderstood by the typical academic biologist, for they have an understanding of life and its purpose and are so identified with the life principle that they think and speak in terms of energy and its effects, and all their activities in connection with the work of the planetary hierarchy are based on a few fundamental formulas which concern life as it makes itself felt through the three differentiations or aspects of energy, force, and matter. Here we seem to be differentiating life from the various types of expression. Life and energy are differentiated, life and force, life and matter. Life and energy are differentiated. Okay, so the only true biologists, they're not trapped in the dynamics of the form. Their consciousness, put it this way, is not trapped in the dynamics of the form. Then cleaning up the spelling. Right, okay. Okay, it should be noted here that only as a man understands himself can he arrive at an understanding of that which is the sum total that we call God, or let's just say the understanding of the macrocosm leads to the understanding of the macrocosm. This is a truism and an occult platitude, but when acted upon, leads to a revelation which makes the present unknown God a recognized reality. And let me illustrate the unknown God. Well, you know, when you see that, our planetary logos is an unknown God relatively to creatures such as we are, and so is the solar logos, so is the cosmic logos, so is the one about whom naught may be said. But let's go here to page 293 of A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and we will see lists of different kinds of deities and solar logos, cosmic logos, and the unknown. So perhaps that's the unknown God, and that is the local, one about whom naught may be said, and above and beyond that one are many, many others, stratified, hierarchically stratified, which can be known as ones about whom naught may be said, until we reach, let's say, the galactic God, which is certainly a one about whom naught may be said. And our universal logos, although we can hypothesize the existence of such a being, is the ultimate in any universe, one about whom naught may be said. So he's going to illustrate how self-understanding leads eventually to the understanding of the unknown God, or at least a very partial understanding. Man knows himself to be a living being and calls death that mysterious process wherein something which he commonly designates as the breath of life is withdrawn. You know, so the, let's just say, breath is fire, breath is life. Is fire, breath is life. This is the idea that the breath animates that which it flows into. So breath and life, from one perspective, are equivalent terms. Breath and being are not equivalent terms, although the breath arises from pure being. We're dealing, you know, sort of with in-universe considerations and extra-universal considerations, extra-universe considerations. By extra, I mean that which is outside of any sphere of activity. On its withdrawal, the form disintegrates. So, interestingly, the breath involves a kind of coherence. Or, let's see, the breath of life sustains the divine coherence. Just about there. The cohesive vitalizing force is gone. And this produces a falling apart into its essential elements of that which has hitherto been regarded as body. So the second ray law of law of cohesion is involved, but the sustaining of the integrated life of the organism is a first ray factor. Okay. So the breath, I guess what he's saying, from one perspective, the breath of life holds organisms in coherence. So when the breath withdraws or is withdrawn, disintegration occurs, and we come into the law of disintegration and the return to the part. The whole is no longer emphasized, and the relationship of the parts within the whole, instead, it's every part for itself, in a way. The cohering factor is gone, the sustaining factor is gone. This life principle, this basic essential of being, but not being itself, and this mysterious elusive factor, because what could be more elusive than the breath? And, you know, the spirit and the breath are identical, and the spirit bloweth where it listeth, like the wind. And no man knows its coming or its going. I'm misquoting that, but you do remember the quote, the basically subtle and elusive wind or breath. We don't know from where it will arise. We don't know how far it will extend. We don't know when it will disappear. And such is our limited understanding of the life cycle and the moment when that cycle will end through the extracting or the discontinuance of the cyclic breath. So this life principle, this basic essential of being, and this mysterious elusive factor is the correspondence in man of that which we call spirit or life in the macrocosm. So the breath is the correspondence of spirit or life. I would like to learn to spell or type more accurately. Just as the life in man holds together, animates, vitalizes, and drives into activity the form, and so makes of him a living being, a coherent, integrated living being, so the life of God, as the Christian calls it, performs the same purpose in the universe, and produces that coherent living vital ensemble, which we call a solar system. And here again, the term universe is applied to a solar system and not the grand entirety. Entirety. And maybe capitalize there. Okay. The life principle to man manifests in a triple manner. Life and breath, in this case, being equivalent. You know, there is a higher way of interpreting life, of course, but life, life and breath are in this example equivalent. Okay, so this life principle manifests as what? First, the directional will, purpose, or incentive. And here we see that will, sometimes differentiated from purpose, is not. It's seen as equivalent. Directional will and purpose are seen as equivalent, and we have to be careful when we examine these words. Sometimes we stratify them, placing one above another, but in a certain way they are equivalent. This is the dynamic energy which sets his being functioning, just as in man, brings him into existence, the monadic will, or that will as transposed into the soul sphere and originating then from the soul, brings the man into existence with every incarnation, fixes the term of his life, and carries him through the years, sustaining him through the years, long or short, and abstracts itself at the close of his life cycle. The directional will, purpose, or basic incentive abstracts itself at the close of his life cycle. I just want to, you know, sometimes, there we go. This is the spirit in man. So, will, purpose, incentive, spirit, and life understood in a certain way. Okay, so all these are equivalent, all equivalent. Will, purpose, basic incentive, life principle, spirit, all equivalent in this particular context. And this manifests as the will to live, which certainly sustains the being in form until that will exhausts itself. Manifests as the will to live, to be, to act, to pursue, that's desire, right? To evolve. In its lowest aspect, this works through the mental body or nature, and in connection with the dense physical, makes itself felt through the brain. Spirit in man. So this is very important, somehow important, that the spirit in man is manifesting as the will to live, to be, to maintain, you know, continuity of presence. Let's put that down to maintain continuity of presence, to act. That has a lot to do with the physical nature, but also the mind, to pursue the desire nature, definitely, and to evolve the mental nature is much involved there. In its lowest aspect, this works through the mental body, or nature, and in connection with the dense physical, makes itself felt through the brain. So this is the, we might say, the first ray aspect of the life principle. We can think of it that way. The first ray aspect of the life principle. Now, this life principle manifests also as a coherent force. It is that, DK is sort of repeating the same thing from various points of view until we really understand how these trinities work, you know, the origination of the initial energy, the sustaining of the relationship created by that initial energy, and the manifestation in denser form of that which the energy has produced through the assistance of the correlating, coordinating force connected with the second principle. So coherent, you know, the law of cohesion is a second ray law in our little universe, our solar system, as the coherent force. It is that significant essential quality. The soul is the quality of life, life quality appearance. Remember that trinity. Remember the trinity of life, quality, and appearance, which makes each man different. So here's what we want to say, and I think it's an important statement. Quality differentiates. Being is non-differentiable. I can look at all kinds of different things all around me, outer world, inner world, and they all have different qualities, but the fact that they are makes them all equivalent in being, equivalent in isness. They are. And that equivalence is what we call being. The equivalence of variegated things is found in being. Okay, so it is that significant essential quality which makes each man different, which produces the complex manifestation of moods, desires, qualities, complexes, inhibitions, feelings, characteristics, which produce a man's peculiar psychology, and we might say DK is, I seem to be in a hurry here, I kind of am. DK is speaking as a trained esoteric psychologist. And this is the result of the interplay between the spirit or energy aspect and the matter or body aspect. Okay, well, as light flashes forth between the poles, so the second aspect is the result of an interplay between spirit and matter. Well, we glibly speak of this interplay, but how it really works will take long in the discovery. This is the distinctive subject of man, his coloring. Notice there are differentiables in coloring or individual note. There are differentiated notes. This it is which sets the rate of vibratory activity of his body, produces his particular type of form, is responsible for the condition and nature of his organs, his glands, and outer aspects. So the inner, well, not just inner, the variety of man, or the variety within a man or among men, is produced by the second aspect of divinity. This is the soul, the differentiating soul, in a way. The soul is both unifying and differentiating. Soul is both unifying and differentiating. This is the soul, and in its lowest aspect is to be seen working out through the emotional or astral nature and in connection with the dense physical body through the heart. So, you know, the heart is the seat of life and of the spirit, but the heart is also the seat of the soul. The heart has a dual function as the recipient of the presence and energy of both the soul and the spirit. Okay. We're getting there, huh? And now, the last. As the activity of the atoms and cells of which the physical body is composed, Okay, we've been looking for three different ways in which the life principle manifests, right? So that's what we're seeing here. Okay, let's see if I can make this a little bit bigger. Yeah. All right. So it's directional will and purpose, basic incentive as the coherent force, and finally as the object, as the activity of the atoms and cells of the physical body, of which the physical body is composed. And this is the objective man. It is the sum total of those little lives of which the human organs comprising the entire man are composed. These have a life of their own and a consciousness which is strictly individual and identified, though not self-conscious. Self-conscious. Uh-huh. Well, that one deserves SCNS. Yeah, we should have that. That should be one of those abbreviations we need. This aspect of the life principle works through the etheric or vital body and in connection with the solid mechanism of the tangible form through the spleen. The spleen vitalizes the solid, apparently solid, that congestion in time and space, which we call the dense physical vehicle. But the noumenon, so to speak, of these different atoms are found on the etheric levels. Therefore, let us remember that the definition of spirit is not possible of accomplishment, nor is the definition of God. He's given us, you know, some very fine thoughts, but words cannot contain the experience of spirit or of God. When one says that spirit is inexpressible, the inexpressible, undefinable cause, the emanating energy, the one life, the source of being, or the source, let's say, of existence, just, you know, which is the way I'd rather say it, because being is causeless, as far as I'm concerned. Being always has been. Come on, how about that? There we go. No, we don't. We have to, there it is, I got it. Suddenly my Finnish keyboard is not friendly to me, or I'm not friendly to it. When one says that spirit is the inexpressible, undefinable cause, the emanating energy, the one life and source of being, or of existence, the totality of all forces, of all states of consciousness and of all forms, the aggregate of life and that which is actively manifested of that life, the self and the not-self force, and all the force, all that force motivates, one is really evading the issue, attempting the impossible and hiding the truth behind a form of words. Well, it's tempting to do that, but it's amazing, you know. DK really understands the indefinability of spirit and that these sounds that we call words really cannot contain it, cannot grasp it. I think, you know, we have to experience identification as spirit, and words can lead us to the threshold, perhaps, but to go into the promised land of identification as spirit, words alone will be veiling and disguising. So we're evading the issue that it is indefinable, attempting the impossible, though we are spirit and we are being. This cannot, however, be avoided until such a time as the soul consciousness is touched and known, and the formless one can be perceived through the clear light of the intuition. So the intuition reveals the I like that APV, and I'm going to make out of that all pervading. All right, the all pervading one. It's inspiring, exhausting, frustrating. It's all those good things. Now, this is a long paragraph, and I'm not going to take it up. I think DK is trying to prepare our minds for the way that we must study all of his writing, and especially White Magic. He's getting practical. In the book, Treatise on Cosmic Fire, first of all, Initiation Human and Solar gave us incentive. So did Letters on Occult Meditation. Then the big picture was presented in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. And now, following that book, the next major book, I think, were the lessons on White Magic, and they became more practical. And he's trying to tell us how we should study these instructions. What are the limitations of our mind? What can words reveal? What do they conceal? So we don't, you know, fall into the trap of thinking that the word is the thing. All right, so let's say that this is the end of A Treatise on White Magic, video commentary number 7. And today, from page, it's up to page 31, is it 26? I always go searching here, and this is a little frustrating. Yeah, it's right, 26 to 31. Okay, and here it is, too, the same. Oh, pages 26 to 31. And here we have the beginning of A Treatise on White Magic, let's make that an M, video commentary number 8, starting from page 31. Okay, I'm hoping this is about an hour in length to go through Master DK's mind, or to allow his mind to enter our mind and illumine, you know, bring things to light, bring order to our thinking. A hierarchical member is a member of society of organized and illumined minds. And may our minds become more organized and more illumined. And through the influence of Master DK and other members of the hierarchy, that can happen if we are sufficiently attentive and persistent. Okay, friends, that's it for the moment. Onward we go, and I'll make sure that this is sent to you via Brett. It will be on Makara and available in other ways as well. Thank you, and bye.